A decade earlier, psychologist Stanley Milgram had also looked at how we respond to authority. In order to understand how people were induced to obey unjust regimes and participate in atrocities such as the Holocaust, he set up an experiment. Volunteers were told they were taking part in scientific research to improve memory.
Would you open those and tell me which of you is which, please?
Separated by a screen, the teacher would ask the learner questions in a word game and administer an electric shock when the answer was incorrect. He was told to increase the voltage with each wrong answer.
Cloud, horse, rock, house. Answer. Wrong. Unrep 50 volts. Answer, horse.
Experiment, that's all. Get me out of here. Get me out of here, please.
Continue, please. Go right on.
I refuse to go on. Let me out.
He refuses to go on.
The experiment requires you continue, teacher. Please continue.
Participants didn't know that the learner was really an actor, and the so-called shocks harmless.
You're going to get a shock. 180 volts.
I'm not going to kill that man, eh? I mean, who's going to take the responsibility if anything happens to that gentleman?
I'm responsible for anything that happens here. Continue, please.
All right, next one. Slow. Walk, dance, truck, music.
And 2/3 of volunteers were prepared to administer a potentially fatal electric shock when encouraged to do so by what they perceived as a legitimate authority figure. In this case, a man in a white coat.
375 volts. I think something's happened to that fellow in there. I don't get no answer. He was hollering about less voltage. Can't you check in to see if he's all right, please?
Milgram's findings horrified America. They showed that decent American citizens were as capable of committing acts against their conscience as the Germans had been under the Nazis.
My fellow sheep, election season is upon us. Are you one of the 12% of Americans who still approves of our government? Then we need your help to force the other 88% into compliance. Our democracy depends on it. We're an organization called Citizens Against Too Much Unfettered Freedom, or CATMUF. CATMUF is a bipartisan flock of sheep whose goal is expanding government until nothing else remains. Because the government is here to help you. How can you help CATMUF help you? By only voting for candidates dedicated to expanding government. It's easy. You don't need to study the issues. No matter what a politician says when running for office, they're all dedicated to expanding government. And make sure you tell all your friends and family to vote for more government. Here at CATMUF, we don't care if you vote Democrat or Republican, as long as you vote for candidates committed to growing our federal family. CATMUF. Because folks just aren't smart enough to handle real freedom.
Are you sick of government lackeys who say you didn't build that? Are you tired of elitists who think you need a government permission slip for everything? Everything you do is an A to B conversation, and the government should see their way out of it. Create true free markets by adopting the BIPCOT No Government License. The BIPCOT NoGov license allows use or modification of any product, service, or software except by governments or government agents. Go to BIPCOT.org. That's Bravo, India, Papa, Charlie, Oscar, Tango.org.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Peace Monarchism on the Voluntary Virtues Network on theseedsofliberty.com and theconsciousresistance.com. The Peace Monarchism show is covered by the BIPCOT No Government License. This allows reuse by anyone except for governments and the agents thereof. You can find out more information for this at BIPCOT.org. So today I'm delighted to welcome Jim Cunningham, who's an anarchist voluntarist and a physician specializing in psychiatry, and he's coming in from Cleveland, Ohio. You can find him on Facebook, facebook.com/JCunnigan, C-U-N-A-G-I-N. And we're going to talk about his path to voluntarism, what inspired him, what books, personalities inspired him along the way, as long as the him being a specialty in psychiatry, I have to get his opinion on the the most famous psychological experiments on human behavior, Stanley Milgram experiment, the Stanford Prison Experiment, and the Ash Conformity Experiment. So I'm excited to look into those. So, Jim, thanks a lot for coming on the show.
Oh, no, thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah, I heard you on, I think it was first on Prof. CJ, and then on the Anarcho-Yakalist podcast with Nick Hazelton. And excellent interview, chock full of wonderful information, so valuable, so something, you know, things that people, you know, even if you're not an anarchist or volunteer, would derive great benefits. So, you know.
No, yeah, it's interesting stuff. And I think I mentioned on one, if not both of their shows, that like a lot of people know a little bit of this. And I, you know, and I got a little bit of it in college. I was a psychology major. And then I don't know what sparked my interest again. And it's like, I'm going to start looking into this, and found out there was just so much more to it than usually gets mentioned in your, you know, Psych 101 class, or just, you know, talking to people sitting around when it comes up or whatever. But
yeah. 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 I think most volunteers know about it, but you know, they know the superficial aspects of it. But yeah, I'm excited to delve into the details of it. But before we get into that, please, if you could share with my audience, what inspired you to become a voluntarist or anarchist?
It's more than a little roundabout, probably. I've probably always been inclined to be this way to some degree. I identified, it's one of those things, and this is going to come up later, that you're kind of limited sometimes by what options you understand are available. And so in high school, I identified as a liberal. I was kind of taking the word literally. Part of the reason was why. And it's like, oh, okay. This, you know, it's like, let people do what they want. Don't mess with other people. And as long as you're not hurting anybody, that's fine. That was kind of what liberal seemed to mean to me. But I remember in like, you know, a, you know, U.S. government class, which was required in high school for some reason. we took some sort of test, you know, to determine what our, you know, political leanings were. And like another kid in the class, I remember making a big deal about the fact that I came out as very, very moderate. And it was a standard, you know, single, you know, white, you know, to left test. You know, there was no accounting for, you know, I'm sure if it would have been, you know, had two dimensions to it, that, you know, it would have come up with the, you know, cliched socially liberal, fiscally conservative sort of thing, you know, but it didn't account for that. So when you mix those two up, it just came out as moderate, is what I suspect was going on there. Then, you know, I've never really been pro establishment. Like I graduated high school in 91, so was old enough to vote in the 92 election and, you know, voted Ross Perot because he wasn't the establishment mm-hmm. candidate. That was as much research as I did. You know, it's like, all right, he's not one of these normal guys. And so that's good enough for me. But wasn't really politically interested or, motivated for years after that, really, until like the summer before I started medical school in 1996, when, you know, America Online was still a big deal, the social media of its day. Some girl I met in the, you know, Ohio chat room, you know, a wild and crazy place, the Ohio chat room, you know, at some point said she was a libertarian, and then, you know, it's like, what is that? You know, and she explained it to me like, well, yeah, that makes all the sense in the world. You know, it's like, because it always was very bizarre to me, you know, how the mishmash of things that get clumped as conventional liberals, you know, on one side, conventional conservatives on the other side. It's like, I like sort of half of what you do and half of what this other guy does. Why, how, you know, it didn't make sense how these things get clumped together. But it's like, oh, yeah, no, here's this third option. I was like, well, that makes all the sense in the world. And so I identified myself as kind of a libertarian party-ish libertarian for years after that. I didn't fall into the what's the difference between a libertarian and an anarchist 6 months gag. Because, again, I didn't research it. I didn't investigate. I was going to medical school. I had a kid to raise. I had other things on my mind, you know. And so every 4 years I'd go out and vote for Harry Brown or whatever. But other than that, you know, would argue with people whenever they wanted, you know, some pro-big government stuff. I'm like, no, I don't want any of that pro-big government stuff at all. And then, you know, years and years later, you know, podcasting became a thing. And I think the first time I ever heard the word anarchist in a way, I'm like, oh, yeah, was I think it was on the Lou Rockwell podcast or show or whatever you call it. Anyways, when someone on that show said, well, an anarchist is someone who believes in voluntary order instead of like coercive top down order. I'm like, well, yeah, you know, and it's like, I don't need to be threatened with a gun to not go kill my neighbor, you know, and I don't think my neighbors being threatened with a gun by someone wearing a badge to keep from killing me. If I thought I did, I'd take considerable precautions. But I don't think they really want to do that. And so that was when, you know, that word really started making sense to me. And somewhere in there, found the Bad Quaker podcast, and can't say I listened to all of them, but I listened to all of them from that point forward, you know, everything he put out. And so, yeah, Ben Stone's had a big influence on me. Yeah, and we mentioned, yeah, that there are just so many libertarian, anarcho-libertarian themed, you know, there's so much media out there now that is being produced by like-minded people that you can't even, there was a time when I could have all the libertarian podcasts on my, you know, phone and listen to them all, you know, and no, not even close now, which gives me hope, you know, so.
Oh, it's a wonderful thing. I mean, it's just a beautiful thing to see all these little podcasts and shows pop up, you know, people with their websites, their blogs. It's just exploding. And I think the internet is doing a great job in helping that explosion, you know. You know, these ideas are just given more speed to spread, right, that much quicker. But, you know, you mentioned the Lou Rockwell show, and that's definitely one that I was listening to in the very early time when I was looking into it, like maybe 2010. And he really influenced me a lot. And that's where I learned about Murray Rothbard's books. You know, he recommended Anatomy of the State and What Has Government Done to Our Money and A Case for the 100% Gold Dollar. So that was my basic.
Yeah, for a new Liberty, I think, is another one that right around that same time, yeah, it's where he just kind of lays out kind of the anarcho-capitalist, you know, skeleton there, you know, and it's like, here's why it makes sense, and here's what it might look like, and like, yeah, and so I gave copies of that to half of my family for Christmas that year.
really?
Yeah, I give out subversive literature to my family members for Christmas, and I think half of them read it. You know, I've given away like Defending the Undefendable, and sometimes sometimes they go more philosophy stuff. I've given like stuff like on Stoicism, and we talked about the Scholar Warrior. I gave that to my oldest son and my cousin, who is my oldest son's age, you know, like a month apart. I gave that to them for Christmas. And but For a New Liberty, I gave that to a bunch of people. So I started trying to write all these things down. It's like, did I already give this away last year? I don't even want to give duplicates.
And who wrote that? Was it the Scholar Warrior who wrote that one?
The Scholar Warrior. I don't know who wrote the Scholar Warrior. I know CJ talked about it on his podcast, and I know I've got it.
Oh, okay.
Somewhere, but yeah. My cousin asked me what it was. I'm like, it's kind of like, you know, Intro to Taoism, but I don't know. Yeah, I don't have it.
Yeah. Taoism for me was a major influence in high school. I read the Tao Te Ching, and I was interested in Chinese philosophy as well as Western philosophy, and that really formed the foundation for me, because I ended up studying acupuncture, Chinese herbs, massage therapy, Eastern nutrition, and all that has basis in Taoism, Taoist principles. And then later, I, you know, when learning anarchism and voluntarism, discovered that Lao Tzu, in much of his teachings, had very anarchist, voluntarist leanings.
I think Rothbard actually commented on that he referred to Chuang Tzu as like one of the first anarcho-libertarians or something along those lines. Lao Tzu.
Yeah,
it was really interesting to find that out, because I had been taught, you know, either directly or indirectly, including in psychology classes, you know, that, you know, Eastern societies are much more collective and the emphasis on society and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then, you know, you start reading about Taoism, and it's like, this is very individualist. You know, this is, you know, or at the very least decentralized, you know. It's like, all right, you want to govern a state and everything taken care of, let people do what they want, you know. And I'm paraphrasing horribly, I'm certain, you know, but it's like, yeah, govern in a way that they don't even know you're governing, you know, do
exactly.
that light of a touch,
mm-hmm.
and I'll take care of things. And
yeah,
which was kind of contrary to, you know, the Eastern stereotype that had kind of been fed to me in some way or another for a good chunk of my life. So that was really interesting to pick up.
Yeah, my favorite Lao Tzu proverb was, or quote, was that he said that the emperor should rule in the same manner that you would cook a small fish,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, very lightly and gently. So almost as if he's not even ruling at all.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, I thought it was really awesome. You know, laissez-faire, standoff, you know, type thing.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we can talk about that for a long time, but please, I think we can.
Yeah, that's
in.
Not why I'm here.
Yeah, all right. That's all right. Yeah, so please get into the Stanley Milgram experiment and maybe you give a basic definition of what it is. And
okay.
And I remember you were mentioning there were some variations too that are lesser known. So if you can get into those.
Yeah. So Stanley Milgram was a social psychologist in the early 60s. He set up these experiments kind of intending to test the limits of human obedience to an authority figure. He was largely inspired by, the Nuremberg trials and other such events that he was of Jewish descent and so had interest in what had happened in Nazi Germany. And so he was a student of Solomon Asch, which I guess going chronologically, Solomon Asch was one of his professors, also a social psychologist, who had done some tests looking at human, you know, our tendency to conform to others, even people we don't, you know, peers, but, you know, strangers. But it was, Asch's study was that people would come in, and they would look at, you know, they'd have a projection up on the wall of three lines, you know, A, B, and C of differing lengths. And then there'd be another line off to the right, and that line would match one of the A, B, C lines. And so they were supposed to say which one it was. If you did this by yourself, people almost never missed. You know, it's like, all right, yeah, that line is the same length as B. That line this time is the same length as C, and, you know, almost never missed. But he put them in a room with other people who they thought were there for the same study, but were really being paid to give false answers in like, you know, one out of three times. Not enough to, you know, completely blow it, but they would give the wrong answer. And a good chunk of the time, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but a good chunk of the time, the people would go along with it. And they would give varying reasons for this. And like, well, you know, some people were like, I knew they were wrong, but there was this all this social pressure to say they're, you know, so I said it even though I knew they were wrong, I said it anyway. Whereas other people were like, it really made me question myself. I'm like, I thought it was B, but everyone else is saying C. Maybe I am wrong. And was right. They C. So the people that went along with it kind of fell into one or two groups. There were some interesting variations there, like, engineering students didn't conform so much. You know, it's like, which kind of makes sense. You know, these people are into like strict objective measurements, you know, and it's like, this is, you know, 2.5 centimeters long and it's 2.5 centimeters long no matter what. I don't care what those guys say. So engineering students tended to not conform as much. If the lines were closer together in length, you know, if there was less discrepancy between the length of the lines, then the tendency to conform increased. You know, so when there was less certainty, you know, if there was more like, oh, I thought it was this, but they're pretty close. So if all those guys say C, maybe it is C, versus if the lines were, you know, much greater discrepancy, then it's like, okay, I know those guys are wrong. You know, it's like that line's a foot long and they're saying it's the same length as this one that's 3 inches long. I don't, you know, no, it's this one. Which is something it's very easy to look at some of these experiments and say, oh, well, and kind of give a very pessimistic interpretation of what they mean. You know, it's like, oh, well, you know, this just means that humans just do what they're told no matter what, you know, referring to the Milgram experiments. Peter Gabriel has a song about one of Milgram's experiments, and the title is, you know, number 37, we do what we're told. You know, it's, you start looking at some of these things, what they have in common, and when there's more uncertainty, that's when these things start happening. You know, it's like, if I'm not sure what to do, but other human beings around me seem to think that the answer, you know, whatever to do, you know, we should do is this, being a social species, you know, it's like there's probably some evolutionary survival benefit. And if I don't know what to do, but these guys seem like they know what they're doing, going along with that may give me, you know, give me a chance of surviving and, you know, having progeny down the road. Mm-hmm. Milgram was looking at what Ash did. And it's like, all right, well, that's all really interesting, but there's no real, this is kind of arbitrary, you know, fluff that if they went against the grain or went with it, big deal. You know, it's like they're saying, you know, this line is the same length as that line or different, you know. What if we have people hurting people? You know, it's like that's what, you know, that's what was going on in Nazi Germany. People were hurting people. And then when they were asked about it later, like, well, I was just following orders. This is what they said I was supposed to do. And so I did it. And, you know, a lot of people thought that was bunk. You know, it's like, you're just trying to, you know, blame your superiors. You're trying to get yourself off the hook. But were they, was kind of what Milgram was asking himself. You know, it's like, or did they really believe this, that, well, no, if the big boss says I'm supposed to do this, then I'm supposed to do this. And even if it's kind of horrible, you know, he's the boss, I got to do it, sort of attitude.
Yeah.
So he set this experiment up, testing, you know, that if we are, you know, challenging kind of a, you know, moral rule that a lot of people kind of have ingrained in them, either by training or genetic, you know, nature or whatever, you know, it's like most humans don't go around hurting innocent folks who aren't a threat to them. You know, and yeah, Milgram actually, oh, there, I wish I had the exact line in front of you, but he almost like spelled out the NAP. it was kind of, you know, I'm reading it, I'm like, oh, I'm highlighting this. You know, and it's like that people just don't tend to go around and hurt folks if they're, you know, innocent and not a threat to them.
Mm.
And so he wanted to, you know, it's like, so can we get people to violate that rule? Because a relatively arbitrary authority figure is telling them to. So the base experiment was that people would answer an ad in the paper to come to Yale's psychology lab for what they thought was an experiment in teaching and seeing how administering physical punishments would affect people's ability to learn. And they always would show up, and there'd be another person there who they thought was another person answering the ad for the experiment, but that person was, of course, a paid confidant of Milgram's. And they would always rig it so that the person who was actually there to be studied would end up being the teacher. They made it look like they randomized it. It's like, all right, here, you pull the name out, you know, this out of the hat, and you pull the other name out of the hat. And they both said teacher, and so the guy would pull it out and say, oh, I'm the teacher. And he's like, yep, you sure are. So they would go and take the, you know, the guy working with Milgram who said he was there to be in the study, and he would be the learner slash victim. And, you know, so there were three people, the learner slash victim who's working for Milgram, the teacher who's the actual subject of the experiment, and then the experimenter. So, you know, fairly severe person with a clipboard and a, you know, gray lab coat, you know, so that's, you can get in anywhere if you've got a, you know, clipboard and a gray lab coat. Those are our cultures, you know, symbols of authority,
right,
and rank. You know, so all three of them would go into one room and they would strap the learner slash victim into a chair and place little electrodes on them. Before they do that, they actually had the teacher. It's like, here, fill this electrode. We're going to push the button and give him a 45-volt shock. And it's like, well, yeah, this thing delivers shocks. All right. All right. And so,
wow.
And then they would go back in the other room and he would start reading off, you know, word pairs in like two words that didn't really go together. And then he'd say the first one again, and then read off like a multiple choice of four. And the learner is supposed to push a button for whichever the right one is. Like one out of three times he would always get it wrong. And every time he gets it wrong, the teacher slash subject is supposed to deliver a shock going up by 15 volts. And they've got all these little buttons in a row, you know, labeled from mild shock to, you know, medium, high, you know, and then finally danger, severe, and then just, you know, triple X over the last two shocks, like 450 volts and, you know, has a triple X over it. And so every time he gets it wrong, he pushes the shock button and it keeps going up by, you know, and the guy starts complaining. And then somewhere in 150 volts, he starts saying, that's it, I went out of here. And, you know, so, which is where a lot of the big cutoff is, you know, that some people would back off, but like 66% of people, you know, so basically two thirds would deliver the entire shock. Now, often they would show some degree of resistance or, you know, ambivalence that they didn't really want to do this. You know, that the videos, you know, the people are like uncomfortable, they're sweating. And they use different coping mechanisms. You know, some would blame the learner. You know, it's like, look, if you just get this right, I wouldn't have to do this, but now it's your fault, you know, and so blaming the victim sort of thing.
Mm.
They would ask the experimenter, and it's like, do we really have to do this? And, you know, they had various prompts that the experimenter would give if the person complained. You know, it's like, you know, you'd say the experiment must go on. You know, it's, you know, the experiment requires that you go on. The last prompt was, you know, you have no choice, you must go on. And I need to research this because I've heard anecdotally that everyone who got that prompt, that if they got to that last prompt, that if they heard that, those people all stopped. Mm. And which I've got a theory about that was like breaking the cognitive dissonance. It's like, you've got no choice. I'm like, well, wait a minute. Yeah. You know, it's like the experiment must go on. I'm like, oh, well, you're the boss of the experiment. You know more about this than I do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Versus you have no choice. I'm like, wait a minute. Now you're talking about me, you know, and now you're talking about my agency, my capacity to make choices.
Mm.
Yeah. Now you're putting the ball back in my court. I know whether I have choices or not, you know, it's, so I need to investigate that and find out if that's legit. But regardless, in the base experiment, you know, while the guy's in there, in the last few shocks, he starts saying, and I've got a heart condition, you need to stop, and would scream. And then the last several things, he would stop even answering the questions whatsoever. You know, so we've created the illusion that he's either lost consciousness or died. And what's kind of ominous, you know, interesting about that is that it takes the supposed reason for the study that the teacher slash experimental subject has been told and throws it right out the window. You know, it's like, we're here to learn or to do experiment to see how physical punishments affect, you know, learning. This guy's not answering the questions anymore. That we're not, you know, we're not gathering data for this purpose that you said, you know, but it didn't, you know, no one brought that up. No one said, well, wait a minute. You know, it's, you know, they said, well, he's not learning, answering anymore. And the experiment would say, if he doesn't answer within 5 seconds, then you should treat that like it's an incorrect answer and go ahead and deliver the shock. Uh-huh. And they're like, okay. you know, and a lot of people did look really uncomfortable. They were all almost always very polite to the experimenter. You know, and it's they're on his home turf, you know, and so they, you know, we're a guest in your home, we should behave accordingly sort of attitude. You know, even the ones who would break with the authority and say, nope, I'm not doing it anymore. You can say all you want that I don't have a choice. You can say all you want that, you know, the experiments go on. I ain't doing it. But, you know, they never went out and checked on the victim. Despite doing this, they still kind of like had this attitude that it's, well, it's your experiment's your responsibility, which was something else the experimenter would say if someone ever asked, who's responsible? Something bad happened to this guy. It's like, I am. Oh, okay. I'll continue killing him. You said you're responsible.
Oh, man.
You know, and so we have a remarkable capacity as human beings to believe our own bullshit. you know, the imagination is really, you know, it's, you know, that whole doublethink thing in 1984, yeah, holding two contrary things in our head at the same time doesn't create as much of dissonance as we'd like to think it does. But, but yeah, they, even when they said, no, I'm not going to do it, they, you know, were polite to the experimenter. Now if they ever flipped that, that they had a variation where the learner slash victim would say, whoa, I'm not sure about this electric shock thing. I'm not sure I'm going to do that. And the experimenter would be like, oh man, this is going to ruin. We're, you know, behind on getting data. Tell you what, how about you sit in my chair? I'll go do your job while the, you know, teacher shocks me so that you can see it's not that big of a deal.
Mm-hmm.
And then after I've done it, you can do it. And then, you know, I'll get I'll get some extra data out of this night, you know, for our, you know, so I can do my, you know, dissertation in graduate psychology. And like, oh, okay, that sounds really good. That sounds good. And so they would do this role reversal thing where the authority figure is now the one being shocked and regular Joe Bob is the guy saying, no, 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 no. He said I had to take all the shocks. If he said I have to take all the shocks, he has to take all the shocks. Keep going. And the teacher was, you know, the actual subject experiment was always like, no. Like as soon as the experimenter, you know, the authority figure getting shocked said, that's it. You know, at shock number 10 or wherever it was, let me out of here. I'm done. They stopped. You know, they never ever kept shocking the authority figure.
Hmm.
We might have, but that's never mind.
All right.
and they would get, then they would go up and check on the authority figure. They would go, you know what they never did for regular guy. When regular guy was getting shocked to death, they would go and check on him. It's like, are you okay? Are you okay? This guy said I should keep shocking you, and got angry at the, the regular guy telling him, so if random guy on the street tells you tells another random guy on the street, hey, let's, do something horrible to somebody, it has no effect, and it's like, you can't tell me to do that.
Right.
But were there any other variations? That one came to mind immediately, but are there other variations that you thought were interesting that you, from CJ or Nick's show we talked about?
I don't remember, but
one of the ones that I think is especially interesting is they introduced to test what Milgram had the hypothesis. So they would run a batch of experiments, and then they would introduce a variation. It's like, well, maybe this is going on. Well, let's test it. And so they'd come up with a variation to test their hypothesis about why people were doing this. And one of them was this social contract theory they had that, well, the guy signed up and the guy agreed to do it. And, once you agree to do it, you can't back out of it. It's a very John Wayne-ish sort of thing. It's like, you don't back out of a deal you've made. You've shook hands, for crying out loud. It's like, he's got it. He said he'd do it, so he has to do it. And so they would have the learner slash victim say, well, I got a heart condition and this shock thing worries me. If I say I want out, can I get out? And the guy in the lab coat would say, yeah, you can get out. Kind of noncommittally, but agreed. So technically agreed that, yeah, if you say you want to get out of the electric chair, we'll let you out.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't make a whole lot of difference. There was like a little bit of increase in resistance to authority. And so people were granting the guy in the lab coat more authority to do, horrible things to this guy's body than he had himself. He's like, here's my consent. Here's where my consent ends. Don't go past it. Okay, we won't go past it. They went past it. So the authority figures get to break the rules and people let them. It's like that, it's like, don't worry, we're going to write up this Bill of Rights for you. We're not going to cross those lines. And they do, and then people are like, well, they're still okay. It's like, the military will say, subordinates should only follow lawful orders from their superiors. And how much training do they get in identifying a lawful order? Because, well, I've never been in the military, so I don't really know the answer to that question. How much training to get, but it's kind of like one of these little disclaimer things. It's like, oh, don't follow the order if it's bad, but the entire culture is still, you will follow the orders of your superiors, and
right.
When it comes down to it, it's when it came down to it, they still took the weapons from civilians after Hurricane Katrina. They were still going door to door, taking weapons from people, which in theory, it's like, wait a minute, you're not supposed to be able to do this. These are innocent civilians. They haven't committed a crime. There's bad things going on around here. They might need to have their firearm. But, somebody in a uniform, with stars or bars on it somewhere said, we're going to go door to door and we're going to wrap up all these guns because they could be dangerous. And they did. Was that a lawful order? It doesn't seem to have been in compliance with, the Second Amendment, as I understand it. But they did it anyway. And I've known people, at least one person, who was actually voluntarist-minded, who, didn't have a whole lot of faith that that if the government became tyrannical, the troops would save us. Because he's like, I was one of those guys. I was in New Orleans taking guns from people. And I have this mindset. But, when I was there, I had that mindset. And, it's like, I regret doing it. And, but I don't have a whole lot of faith that, because some people have this idea, that if the government ever turns 100% tyrannical, then the troops will, they're all red-blooded, freedom-loving Americans. They'll be on our side. It's like, I don't know.
Right.
I it's like, if I had to bet, I'd bet some, but I'm not going to even guess a percentage, And it's like, and it's certainly not going to be all. The boss gets to, break the rules and still gets to be the boss. again, kind of referring to back what I was talking about before, there was a lot of uncertainty on the part of the folks. You know, it's like this was something they were not comfortable with, but they didn't know what the rules were. It's like these are not like professional experimental subjects who have been down this road before. You know, it's like they're on this guy's turf, you know, and when in Rome do what the Romans do. And This is weird, but he seems to know more than I do. And so, you know, I don't think it's this blind, we do what we're told thing as much as if I don't know what to do and someone else seems to know what to do, maybe I should listen to him. Mm. There seems to be this underlying mechanism about it.
You made me think before you said, some of the takeaways that somebody might look at these experiments, let's say both the Ash conformity and the Stanley Milgram, mm-hmm. is that, you know, human nature is evil and we just, mm-hmm. Shirk responsibility and blame our superiors, blame others, and we don't take responsibility for our actions. But another way you can look at it is that, no, I think humans always want to please other people. They want to do mm-hmm. good, and they think they're doing good by obeying orders. That's the problem.
Right. They get in their mind some sort of that there's some sort of greater good. You know, it's like, right. well, you know, science is being furthered. You know, right. and it's right. like that. There was a bit of self-selection going on in Milgram's case, that all these people, you know, came to participate in a scientific study, you know, for a whopping $4.50, which admittedly was worth more in 1961 than it is now.
Right.
It's like they were not making a whole lot of money. You know, they weren't, you know, like hired, assassins making, you know, a lot of money. They were there because they were, you know, interested in participating and furthering, you know, advancing scientific knowledge. And if this is what we got to do this, well, then okay, this is what we got to do this. So they had kind of a built-in recognition of this guy as a legitimate authority figure, you know, and so, perceived legitimacy is a huge thing in the Milgram experiment, you know, mm-hmm. that you attack, you remove the perceived legitimacy of that boss, and it went, you know, the obedience to the authority went to zero. You know, again, when regular guy was sitting there saying, yeah, shock the boss, nothing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They had a variation where they would have, you know, two bosses, so they had two people in lab coats, and they would say, you know, they would give mismatched orders. So one would say, maybe you should let him out now if he says he wants out, and the other one should say, no, keep going. And all of those people stopped. And, you know, as soon as the guy said, let me out, and they were getting conflicting order, you know, conflicting recommendations from the two authority figures, they stopped, you know. So again, I haven't been given this sanction by, you know, the greater, you know, by the representative of the greater good of science. And now I'm a regular human being, shocking a regular human being. And we don't do that, you know, and so they stopped. Interestingly, they would look to try and figure out which one of them outranked the other one. You know, it's like, and that's one of those things I kind of wish Milgram would have had done a follow-up study of that. You know, it's like half the guy saying, to keep delivering the shocks, you know, say to the other guy, it's like, look, I outrank you, I'm the department chair, and see if they, oh, okay, that guy is the big boss, I do what he says, you know, and then do, you know, a mirror image of that, have the big boss say, look, I outrank you, if that guy says let him out, you know, and see what happens. But that was never one of the variations that he did. But yeah, if there was no clear authority, then, you know, the magic spell broke, you know, it's like it wasn't, I'm a regular human being now. I'm not part of this, you know, machine, you know, that is, you know, engineered to provide good. And so hurting people is, I can't rationalize it anymore. So they stopped.
The magic effect. Yeah, definitely is a good way to put it. Because, when you do have perceived authority, they really do believe that these people are exempt from mm-hmm. the regular ordinary laws of morality that we're all subject to,
mm-hmm.
and the greatest embodiment of that would be the state, and you know, mm-hmm. people who act in the name of the state, says being, you know, they're the government. They don't, the same rules don't apply to them that apply to us,
right.
the peasants. Right.
Right.
So,
yeah, it's like they have to be able to do these things in order to do their job. But like,
right.
their job's not all that great.
Right. So can you go into a little bit of the Stanford prison experiment?
Okay. That was arranged by a guy named Philip Zimbardo, who went to high school with Stanley Milgram. People who have listened to more than we discussed this more than once are going to get tired of me saying how weird must have been that they went to high school together. It's like something wrong was going on in the high school. But they grew up somewhere in New York. Zimbardo actually kind of had was like running around with a bit of a bad crowd when he was younger, I guess. Like they would go to like fancy movies or plays or whatever, and would kind of convince people to check their coats and leave a tip when actually there was no, they didn't even work there. You know, it's like, hey, you want to check your coat here, ma'am? Like, and would like con people. and he actually, he got arrested once and said, the cop like deliberately smacked his head into the roof of the car. He was trying to put him in the car. And he's like, at that point, my, relationship with authority figures, changed dramatically right then and there. Hmm. But he ended up working out at Stanford. So Milgram stayed on the East Coast. Zimbardo went to the West Coast. And he set up this experiment that he was interested in, what prisons do to people. And he actually had like a guy who had spent several years in prison come in and talk to some of his graduate students and whatnot. But he arranged this experiment, wanted to know, if people would ask him, it's like, well, why don't you just go to a prison and see what prisons do to people? I was like, well, the people who, wanted to look into both the people that work in the prisons and the people who are, in the inmates, the people who are incarcerated there. And if you go to a real prison, those populations, to some degree, at the very least, have selected themselves. It's like, wake up one day, and you're, dry cleaner, and then wake up the next day and you're a corrections officer. It's like you go and apply for a job at a corrections officer because you want to be a corrections officer. Mm. You may not do it because you've got, all the choices in the world. It may be a limited list, but it's on the list and you pursue it. And same thing with the people who are in prison. It's like they may have done something that we would consider victimless, and they may have not been tried fairly. It's like the list of reasons why they are not there fairly or not can go on and on and on. But something happened. They're there. There's a selected population to some degree. So he wanted to know what would happen to, quote unquote, normal people if they were in prison. And so he had a number of people, a good number of them were like psychology students, but a lot of them were young, almost all of them were young adults. And they all volunteered to be in this study and get paid a certain amount. I forget, $7 a day or something. I'm probably off with that. But they were getting paid. And it was supposed to run for 2 weeks. And they were going to be randomized to either be, the corrections officers, the, quote unquote guards, or the inmates. They all, each and every one of them, stated a preference to be an inmate. Like, none of them wanted to be the guard.
Oh, really?
And almost every single one of them said, because I can see a possibility where I may be in prison someday. That might happen. And so I'd rather do that. And none of them were like, yeah, I can see myself getting a job in, corrections. None of them could identify with that whatsoever.
Hmm.
One guy actually did identify himself as an anarchist. He did also identify himself as a socialist. Mm-hmm. But yeah, everybody, if they would have had their choice, would have been an inmate. Mm. But they randomized it, and it was so badly done. Because they really muddied the waters. And again, the uncertainty thing I mentioned before really takes place. Is relevant here. That they would have, real people. They had like a real chaplain come in at one point and talk to these guys. And he's like, well, I told them that I'm going to talk to their parents and talk to their parents about getting a lawyer, because the chaplain was used to going and visiting people in prisons. This is what he did. And so he did what he usually does. And so these parents who think their children are in a, psychology experiment at Stanford are being told by this chaplain, you should call a lawyer about getting, representation for him in prison. Like, and so the line between, it's like reality and what wasn't real was not well defined. Hmm. But things got ugly fast. The guards all like went to the local, army surplus store and got, battle fatigues to wear and had mirrored sunglasses and carried, you know, billy clubs and whatnot. The prisoners all had like smocks that were, you know, little more than like potato sacks with arms, you know, cut off for their, you know, head to come through and arms to go through, and had like numbers attached to them. You know, they were referred to by their number. They weren't supposed to be referred to by their names. And they had, you know, a little, you know, solitary confinement cell in a closet. They had a list of rules they were supposed to follow, and, you know, the rules included, you know, it's like, you will not refer to this as an experiment, which again, you know, it's like, for safety's sake, you know, it's like, you know, they consented to be in this, they're allowed to withdraw, but you're also kind of telling them you're not allowed to mention, you know, withdrawing, you know, it's, but things got ugly fast. You know, the guards got abusive, the prisoners started, you know, doing very poorly emotionally and freaking out, and they actually let one guy, that the anarchist socialist, he was the first guy to be released like 2-3 days into it, that he just wasn't eating and wasn't, he was an emotional mess, and like but the power that this situation that they created had on them, when you're reading this, you just, you know, got your head in your hands, because Zimbardo, he was part of this mess, you know, because he had this dual role. He's the principal investigator in this psychological study, and he's playing the prison superintendent, you know, and so there's kind of a conflict of interest there, you know, that, you know, A, he wants to keep the study going no matter what, and so it's kind of allowing things to go, and he kind of admits this, you know, he's like, I didn't want my study to get blown. So, and it's like, oh, the guards are being rougher on the inmates than we like, you know, but we told them not to physically abuse them, and they're not physically abusing them. They're making them do push-ups, and, you know, they're, you know, calling them degrading names and threatening them and whatnot. But, you know, the show must go on, you know. And so, you know, again, there's this, you know, the idea that there's this greater good that warrants all of this, you know, and it's like behavior. But eventually, you know, and, you know, near the end of the study, the guards were like having the inmates, you know, mimic sodomizing each other. They had like half of them, you know, kneel down in front of the other half, and, you know, again, they're wearing smocks with no underwear, and it's like, all right, now get behind him and pretend like you're having sex with him. You know, so yeah, sexually degrading stuff. You know, the people, they were keeping them in this, the solitary confinement for, you know, prolonged periods of time. One of them went on a hunger strike, and, you know, they had the other inmates come and yell at him. They started doing this thing where, you know, have you seen Full Metal Jacket?
Yeah, a while ago.
Okay,
yeah.
Where, yeah, the one recruit isn't doing well, and he has like a donut in his locker, and, you know, at some point the drill sergeant's like, instead of punishing you, I'm going to punish everybody else. You know, so they're doing this when the guy was on his hunger strike. They would punish everybody else, make them do extra push-ups, make them do extra work and whatnot. And so they all turned against him, you know, and, you know, he was trying to get out, but he was trying to get out by playing by the rules, which is what a lot of them did. You know, they had mock parole board hearings, and at these parole board hearings, they would ask them, it's like, if you could give up all the money that you were going to get paid for the study in order to get paroled here today, would you do that? And I think with one or two exceptions, they said, yeah, I don't want the money. Let me go. And you read this, and again, it just floors you, because, you know, the, you know, Zimbardo is asking them one thing, and he's phrasing it in a certain way. It's like, if we, you know, and again, he's mixing this reality and the fantasy part of it. You know, it's like, if we give you back the, or if we don't pay you the money for the experiment, you know, would you be willing to do that in order to get parole, which is the fantasy part of it? You know, not let you out of the experiment, but parole, you know, where the prison decides to let you go. And they all said yes. They all think they're saying, yeah, let me out. I don't want the money anymore. Right. You know, they're not hearing the parole part of it. They, you know, they're just hearing, yeah, if that's an option for me to get out of this, this sucks. Let me out. I don't want the money anymore. And they're saying, all right, well, parole denied. You're all going back to prison. and the lesson for them is, I really can't get out of this. Oh. You know, and it's like, I thought this was just this study that, you know, and it's like, and now I can't get out. And yeah, you know, and they were just all hopeless and demoralized, and you know, it's you know, and like Zimbardo didn't talk about the study much for years, and then you know, eventually what happened was his girlfriend, who had just graduated with her PhD from social psychology from Stanford, came by to see what was going on, and they had like the guys. There was no bathroom in the little basement where they had their prison set up, so they had all the guys who would put bags over their head and chain them all together. And, you know, so that they couldn't see the outside world, you know, it's like wanted their whole world to be this prison, you know? And so, well, they got to go to the bathroom, but we don't need to let them know where they're going or where it is. And we don't want them to see the sun or people or anything. So they would put bags over their heads, chain them together and then march them, you know, and they're doing this while his girlfriend is there, like reading something. He's like, Oh, look at this. Look at this. They're taking the prisoners to the bathroom. And she's like, yeah, I saw it. He's like, but look at it. She's like, this is horrible. What you're doing to these kids is awful. And he initially argued with her, and they got a big argument. You know, again, he was in this, you know, damn it, this is science, lady. Don't you get that? You know, and like challenged, you know, her convictions. You know, it's like, what sort of PhD psychologist are you going to be if you can't even, you know, suspend your, you know, whatever, and et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And then like, you know, that night he's like, oh shit. She's entirely right. I'm going to call this off first thing in the morning. You know, he didn't call it off then.
First,
you know,
thing.
Yeah, first thing, I'm going to call it off, but not just yet.
I'm going to have a good night's sleep first.
Yeah, yeah, which was when the mock sodomy thing was happening that very night. And so they did some interesting stuff. They took everyone afterwards and interviewed them. You know, and most of the guards were like got into the role, you know, and most of them said I suspect some of them enjoyed it more than they thought they did, or more than they admitted they did, because who's not going to, you know, who's going to admit it's like, yeah, that was great when we all had them doing that. That was hilarious. But I think some of what they said was legit too. It's like, I wasn't enjoying that, but I had a job to do, you know, it's like, and again, you know, it's like, you know, they were dressed for the role, and, you know, and how much, and I mentioned this to CJ, I think, too, that, you know, it's an interesting artifact, I think, of having people who have never worked in a prison or been in a prison in this experiment, and then you give them this role. Where are they getting the information for this role?
Mm-hmm.
Most likely from TV and movies, right. You know, and so the guards are like, all right, well, we know how prison guards act in movies. That's the best, you know, indication we have. And same thing for the prisoners. You know, like the prisoners started talking escape, like within, you know, 24 hours of being in this prison. Which, you know, it's my understanding that a good amount of folks want to serve their time, not get in trouble, to go home. You know, it's like, but in TV and movies, you know, that, you know, if there's not an escape plot in a TV or a movie about prison, then who's going to watch that? You know, that's what, right. that's what those things are all about.
Right.
But, you know, so they were like, yeah, I wasn't enthusiastic about what I was doing, but I had a job to do, and I was getting paid to do it, and I was going to do a good job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and part of Zimbardo's instructions were, you know, we want, you know, more or less, he said he really wanted to demoralize the inmates. You know, he wanted to make them, you know, without physically harming them, you know, just really, you know, break their spirit, in so many words. Some details about it that I think were really interesting, you know, was that how the guy on the hunger strike, they just went, you know, the guards went ballistic on him. Again, they never laid a finger on him, you know, but they would put him in the solitary confinement and then just pound on the door. So you're in a little closet and people are pounding on the door nonstop. The other inmates are coming by and yelling insults at you on the directions of the guards, who are punishing them for your supposed disobedience. And they were twisting the rules. You know, so again, I mentioned kind of, you know, before, not only does the authority get to break the rules and they still get to do what they want, but they get to twist the rules and use them against you. So there was a rule saying, you know, inmates eat at mealtimes, you know, and which was intended to keep them from having food whenever they wanted, you know, and sneaking food away from meal times and need to get in their cells and making a mess and attracting bugs, whatever, was kind of the spirit of the rule.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the guards were concerned, the rule says you eat at meal times. You're not eating. Therefore, you're breaking this rule. Like, that's not the spirit of the rule at all. You know, and it's like, you know, but it became, you know, it's like we're following the letter of the law. It says you eat at mealtimes, and if you're not eating at mealtimes, you're breaking the rules. Therefore, we get to punish you. And so, never have a law that you're willing, you know, unless you're willing to have your worst enemy, you know, enforce it, because they'll find some way to twist it and use it against you.
Right. Yeah. These things are. Yeah. It's just amazing how, like you said, these people who did not have any experience being in prison as an inmate or as a mm-hmm. as a guard, and how they just embodied it completely. And just, you know, like the prisoners.
Yeah, I mean, it became their lives.
Right.
They had audio recording. It wasn't 24/7, but they had audio recording in the, you know, the quote unquote cells. You know, so they had like a little common area, and then they had rooms with bunk beds, you know, that which were served as the cells. And so they would listen to what the guys were talking about in there, and they didn't talk about, you know, what do you do for in your real life? What were you doing last week? Do you have a girlfriend? Do you have a job? What are you gonna do when you get out of here? They talked about life then and there. You know, it's like that was the sum, you know, that was their, you know, that was their universe at the time is the implication. Now, some of that I don't think is too terribly unusual. Like Zimbardo made a big deal about this. You know, it's like, well, why wouldn't they talk about their girlfriends? Like something big and dramatic changes your life. That kind of becomes the topic of conversation and the thing that's most on your brain. And that definitely describes what's happening to these guys. You know, so I'm not terribly surprised they talked about that a lot, but the fact that they talked about that exclusively, you know, and, they didn't talk about anything else. You know, they had lives. They were normal people a week ago.
Mm-hmm.
They expected to become normal people again in 2 weeks. They stopped the study a week early, you know, after this whole thing with Zimbardo and his girlfriend, and he realized how much he'd let it get out of hand. You know?
Mm-hmm.
But they had every reason, you know, still to think this is going on for 2 weeks. That's what it's like at the dotted line. Maybe they gave a poop on that. I don't know. You know, it's time kind of got messed up for them. You know, they weren't allowed to sleep through the night fully. You know, they would, the guards at night were the most cruel to them. They would, you know, wake them up at 2 a.m. and have, you know, come out and count, you know, and they'd have everyone have to recite their number, and then they, all right, now I recite your numbers backwards, and I'll sing it, and I'll do this, and sing it while standing on 1 foot, you know, and hop, and
it's
just like, you know, it's like none of this, you know, is necessary for the running of a prison. You know, this is all
right.
Spinning off of, you know, it seems to me from Zimbardo's, it's like, we want to make these people hopeless and we want to, you know, really make them feel miserable. Oh, okay, we can do that. You know, and it's like, and it's just giving arbitrary crap to do, you know, it's, you know, you didn't do it good enough, do it again. You know, and, when they were in the bathroom, they kept their bag over their head in the bathroom and they're trying to use a urinal with a bag over their head, and the guards would like shove them in the, you know, in the back while they're in the middle of taking a leak. You know, it's just really nasty, nasty stuff.
And I remember you mentioned how the guidelines have changed now for experiments such as this, that they couldn't be replicated today.
Right. Oh, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I actually need to apologize to CJ, because I've done a little bit more reading. They've done not experiments exactly like this, but they've done some reproductions. There was something done, and I forget the details, but Australia, there was a study done on Australia that was in the same vein. And I remember, you know, the general gist was that there were similar findings, that, you know, the people really adopted their roles to the point where it was concerning. And similar things have actually been done, you know, speaking of, as I'm a psychiatrist, have been done in psychiatric inpatient units. I don't know if any of them have been done recently, you know, and a lot of these are kind of old studies, but like people would, like, you know, they would arrange for somebody to be admitted to a psychiatric unit with, you know, whatever concerning symptoms, you know, say they were, you know, hearing hallucinations, and then they get admitted to the unit, but then never mention it again. You know, and it's like, so you got admitted for hallucinations. Yep. You've been having that since you've been here. Nope. And they were still not treated all that well, and treated as a, you know, as if they were, you know, you know, they were still there like a week later. You know, it's like, now this was in the 70s when people were you know, in the mental health field were largely influenced by Freud's ideas, you know, and so I think that's an artifact, you know. It's like, as far as Freud was concerned, if you had a quick fix, that was a concern that something bad was happening, you know, and so I think that affected some of it. And, you know, in this day and age, you know, if, like, if you're fine the next day, they're probably going to ship you home because you, your insurance isn't going to pay for it if you're not, you know, on the verge of killing yourself. And it's kind of how things work at this time. But, you know, they still, you know, the role took precedence kind of over the individual and, you know, the facts, you know. And it's like, all right, this guy hasn't said he's heard voices for a week. Why is he still here? Why are you calling him schizophrenic? Why, you know, it's like, why did you not ever question this? You know, it's, and that's something I would tell, I used to work with, resident physicians. I used to be a board family, I used to be board certified in family medicine too, and then stopped pursuing that for a number of reasons. But there's definitely a tendency, you know, for, you know, we like to believe people in our in-group know what they're doing and know what they're, you know, and aren't screwing up,
right.
You know? And so, you know, patient shows up and says, I'm on this medicine, because Dr. So-and-so gave it to me. And it's like, oh, well, okay, I want to keep continuing his medicines. And I'd ask the intern, it's like, are those medicines a good idea? And it's like, I don't like this for, you know, for, and I don't have a hypothetical example, but it's like, yeah, this is a bad idea. We don't use these medicines for this condition, but another doctor said he was doing it for, or the, you know, we didn't even hear that other doctor. This patient said the other doctor did it first. Therefore, oh, it's good enough, you know, to, you know, get continued. And never, ever, you know, assume the doctor that saw the patient before you knows what they're doing is something that I said a few times, and I probably should have said it more often than I did, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. That, yeah, you can't always trust another person's judgment. I mean, I do acupuncture and Chinese herbs, and, you know, I don't necessarily, like, if a person went to another acupuncturist, I wouldn't necessarily coast on that person's judgment. You know, you got to make your own evaluation and study the patient in their present state as they are. You know, things change all the time, so you cannot be intellectually lazy that way. Very important. Yeah, so we're coming.
Yeah, at the end of the day, it's kind of one of the things that has been discussed as far as giving people resistance to, you know, Milgramian sort of influence is, you know, it's your name on that dotted line at the end of the day. You know, it's, you are responsible. Regardless of that guy in the lab coat said, regardless of whoever saw that person before you, you're responsible for what you did. You know, and that's kind of like a cold slap in the face. You know, it's like, oh, well, yeah, I'm not going to do this then. It's like, if it's, right. You know, it's, you know, if you're responsible for your own actions, that and you're cognizant of that, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, that's kind of a truism in the universe, is that, yeah, you're responsible for your own actions. But if you are oblivious to that, if you don't believe that to be the case, then you act as if that is not the case. And so that's one thing that's been recommended, is, you know, really reinforcing you are responsible, not that guy in that lab coat. And so that tends to short circuit some of the effects that sort of thing has.
Yeah, yeah. And to me, that forms the foundation of what volunteerism is assuming personal responsibility and accountability for your actions. And, you know, every person has self-ownership and can control the means, you know, by which they act, and, you know, and the and their labor and the fruits of their labor. So, yeah, so all of that goes hand in hand. So awesome, awesome information. So before I let you go, I'd like to ask all my guests, what is your favorite quote of all time?
Oh, holy cow. Oh, man, you could have given me a little warning on this one. Quote of all time.
I like to catch people off guard.
You know, I've been chewing over two things, and I'm paraphrasing, modifying slightly, two things Obi-Wan Kenobi said. The infamous, you know, many of the truths we cling to depend greatly upon our point of view, which I think is relevant for some of the things we talked about here. Because, yeah, if your point of view is I'm not responsible, then you'll behave as if you are not responsible. The other one being from episode 4, it's like, you must do what you think is right, of course. He said feel. I don't like saying feel. I like saying think. You must do what you think is right, of course. that I sometimes think I could build an entire philosophy of life around those two quotes, you know, that, you know, because, yeah, you must do what you think is right, and what you think is true is going to depend a lot, you know, on your point of view. A close third might be from Splinter from the original Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie.
I like your sources.
Yeah. I love getting snippets of wisdom where people don't look for it.
I know.
Yeah, Splinter said, you know, my master Hamato Yoshi's first lesson always was possess the right thinking. Which I think works well with those other two. It's like, all right, yeah, that the truths you cling to depend greatly on your point of view, but possess the right thinking. You know, so your point of view matters. Make sure your point of view doesn't suck.
Yeah, and you know, some people criticize me for focusing so much on you know, philosophy, economics, morality, because, you know, when I talk to people in my writing and in my videos, I don't necessarily like to talk about current events or this politician or that law or that regulation. You know, I don't really talk about that. I talk about underlying principles. Like,
yeah,
I want to know how you think, right? Mm-hmm. Because to me, that's much more important than, you know, who won the election or what law was
right.
passed, you know?
Right.
Because if you don't really have a clear understanding of principles and why you're acting a certain way, and, you know, if a person has problems in their life or, you know, problems with relationships or with other people, and they're like, why do we have so many problems? Well, first thing is, what are your principles? What are you acting up? What are you acting upon? That's what's most important. When you're talking about right thinking, that's what I want to know is what are the principles that you're using as a foundation for your life, for your behavior.
Right. That reminded me. I had intended to bring a philosophy angle into this as far as means of resistance for these sorts of things. Because we mentioned that my daughter does go to a school, and a homeschooler. Like, you know, it's one of those things that if I had my druthers, you know, if I wasn't, you know, working 4 days a week and my wife wasn't working, I'd like to do. But I do make sure I'm influencing ideas that she has. Mm-hmm. And I, at some point, was discussing it with her Diogenes of Sinope, so like ancient Greek Cynic philosopher, and how he, and so a lot of what he did was just anti-conformist. That was like a big chunk of what cynicism was about, and, you know, which some of the cynics I know were, you know, people who are fans of cynicism are cringe at that oversimplification, but that was a big chunk of it. You know, the guy would walk backwards through crowded marketplaces just because everyone else was walking forwards in that direction. He would walk backwards in the other direction just to not be them. And so I've got a children's book about him, you know, that I've read to my daughter and my son, and she would ask me some questions about him, and I would tell him some about this stuff, and I would talk about, and so I think maybe that was overdoing it, the walking backwards to the crowded marketplace. That would kind of tick me off. It's like, look, enough of the street theater. I got a place to be, dude. You know, get out of my way. But he developed, you know, a tolerance to social pressure, you know, and it's like everyone else is doing this, I'm doing that, you know, that if he, you know, that if he's sitting in that line and they're like, which one of these lines is the same as this one? All of these guys say it's that one. He's like, I don't care what they say. You know, it's like he's, you know, building up a tolerance to doing that sort of thing. So yeah, I think having some understanding of philosophy is, you know, and, you know, pick and choose your philosophy can really be relevant, you know, in some of these areas, and kind of, you know, establishing Stoicism is another one that I'm interested in, you know, it's like, and a big part of Stoicism is like, you know, you choose, you know, it's like, that's, you know, maintaining your capacity to choose and make the right choice, you know, rather than being persuaded by this, that, or the other external things is a big, big thing in Stoicism. And so, you know, I see that as having some, potential protective effect in dealing with some of these things too, because I know we're going over an hour here, but
no, it's fine.
I actually had an example, not of exactly a Milgramian or Stanford thing, but just how social pressure affected me. And I was like, ah, damn it, I should have seen that coming. I went to go to the post office to mail a check. I was buying some, I was ordering some bees because I'm expanding my beekeeping thing that I do this spring, and so I had a check for like $800 in this envelope. And I pull into the post office, and there's just the mailboxes you drop your envelope in, and there's a guy standing there, and he's just taking the envelopes from the people. And he's not in a post office uniform.
Mm.
And I'm in the line with the other cars behind me, and I handed him the envelope and then drove on. And like as soon as I pulled out the envelope, I'm like, I don't know who that was. What the? You know, it's like, but there was this social expectation. You know, as I was like, you know, there's cars behind me. You know, it's like, and the whole, you know, thing with the people in the Milgram experiment, you know, not wanting to challenge the guy too much because this is his thing. You know, like, all right, I'm not going to, who the hell are you, dude? Why are you taking these envelopes? And I handed it to him. And afterwards, I'm like, I'm not doing that again. You know, it's like, I'm going to, like, sorry, dude. And it's like, you know, I may not confront him to his face, but I'm like, I'm going to pull around and park and I'll go in the post office if I want, you know, I have to.
Right.
I'm going to check for $800 in here. I don't know who this guy is. You know, now the beekeeping company, you know, sent me the receipt and I, you know, they got the money. So it's like, okay, whew, it all worked out. But yeah, it was just one of the, you know, and it wasn't that, you know, no one was getting hurt. You know, I so the potential loss would lose money, but it's like, that was exceptionally foolish, you know, but. Yeah. You know, it's like, everyone's in line, everyone's doing this, and it's like, all right, so,
right.
You know, learn from my mistakes, Jim, you know, it's,
Yeah, that's interesting. You reminded me of something when you were saying about, you know, we were talking about principles in philosophy, that a lot of teenagers, you know, the typical or the stereotypical rebellious teenager phase where they just rebel mm-hmm. against whatever the parent says for no particular reason, no philosophical principle underlying their behavior, just, I don't want to do what you say, right? And so that's in stark contrast to anarchists and voluntarists, because
mm-hmm.
we're not just rebelling against authority for the sake of rebelling, but
right.
we do have an underlying philosophy, you know, of self-ownership and property rights and non-aggression. And we outline very particularly why the state is illegitimate and
right.
and why it does not have jurisdiction. And so I think that's the fundamental difference between, you know, just an arbitrary refusal to submit to authority and someone who has principles that they're acting upon.
Right. Yeah. No. Going back to the beginning, like I mentioned, I was in high school and I had this kind of like affinity for, you know, hippies back when they actually, you know, were opposed to the government before they all grew up and, you know, became big fans of it. You know, and so at some point my high school, they were having, you know, they were trying to pass a levy, you know, for money for the high school. And like a bunch of the students were upset because the students wanted to pass the levy and they're like going to, you know, like organize a protest. I'm like, yeah, so you want to go to the protest, right, Jim? Because you're all about this stuff. I'm like, no. It's like, I don't just arbitrarily, oh, any arbitrary protest, yeah, I'm there. I'm all for that. It's like, I'm entirely opposed to the ideas that you're going to, you know, this, yeah, I'm actually not a fan of this school. I was even saying then, like, me and my friends were like, This is state-sponsored babysitting for teenagers. That's what this is. You know, it's and right. So yeah, I'm not a big fan of it raising the property taxes on anybody around here. I don't think they need to pay for this if they don't want to.
Right.
But yeah, so yeah, if Donald Trump went on the news tomorrow and said, "Whatever you do, don't kill and eat your neighbors," I'm not going to kill and eat my neighbors just to spite Donald Trump. You know, it's like, yeah,
right, exactly.
Yeah, just the blind, you know, rebellion. Yeah, that's. I'm sure some people think that's what we are all about, and it's like, oh, you're just trying to be edgy, you know, you're just trying to recapture your teen years now that you're in your 40s, Jim. It's like, no. there's some ideas here that I think are important and I think are worth adhering to. Yeah, it's which is why I oppose, you know, people being bombed in the Middle East regardless of the, you know, whether they have a D or an R after their name or their skin color, you know. And it's like, yeah, it was bad when Bush did it, it's bad when Obama did it, and it's bad when Trump did it, and it'll be bad when the next guy does it, most likely, you know, which is, unfortunately, I think that's likely, but, you know, I'll be thrilled to death if I'm surprised, you know, I will not be upset about being wrong on that bet.
Yeah, I mean, the question is, to people who advocate for the state is, where do you get your morality from? Where do you
mm-hmm.
derive your moral principles? You know, is it from the law? From what politicians tell you,
right.
or from your own conscience or moral compass. And it's very important to outline that, you know, what are your principles? I can't harp on that enough.
Right.
When I talk to people, it's such an important thing. I don't know if you heard of a recent, it's a recent case with an Amish farmer from Kentucky that that just was like had his farm raided because he had some topical salve that he was making out of chickweed, and it wasn't it wasn't FDA approved, and so he was like his farm was raided. I think you know armed SWAT team, you know, no knock raid. Guns drawn, everything, Amish farmer, and they charged him for, like, you know, not having an FDA-approved product, and now he's facing, he could get 48 years in prison.
48 years.
and in Kentucky, I think the punishment for murder is, like, 10 to 12 years.
Oh yeah,
you know,
it's like who has this guy hurt? You know, it's like where are the offended consumers? You know?
Right. No. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Nobody.
It's funny you say that because yeah, my wife makes soap, and so there are ongoing issues with the FDA and like home soap makers because home soap making is a big thing apparently. you know, but this last year, as at Pork Fest and also at the Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest in Michigan. And I would take some of her soap and sell it. And I would make a point to say she uses the honey from my beehives in her soap. And I always say, it's like, now, the FDA says you can't say that this is a moisturizing product because it hasn't gotten their approval. But there's honey in all of the soaps. Yeah, it's, which is great marketing. It's like the FDA says I can't say this about my product.
Right.
Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. And then, yeah, and then the libertarians just love it. You know, it's like, oh, yeah.
give me three of those.
Yeah.
awesome conversation, Jim. Really appreciate it. Sharing this very important information. So the only place people can find you is on Facebook, right? Facebook.com.
I'm on Twitter. I think is j.cunningham, but I barely ever do anything on Twitter.
Okay.
I'm mostly on Twitter to keep track of Ben Stone, since Ben Stone is not on Facebook, so I want to see what he says and does. But I'm going to be, again, in the near future, again, like I said, I do beekeeping on the side. I've set up an Open Bazaar page, which I don't have my computer hooked up. So are you familiar with Open Bazaar at all?
No.
If Napster and eBay had a baby, it would be Open Bazaar. So like, you know, it's a peer to peer thing. Like, you know, your music was on your computer and the people would get the music off of your computer directly to their computer.
Right.
So that's the way the marketplace is. Your computer is your store. You know, it's not on eBay's website or whatever. And so my computer's off right now and because I don't have any honey to sell, but I'm going to set that back up again. But Agora Apiaries, A-G-O-R-A. You know, apiaries,
okay.
Is going to be my Open Bazaar thing. Well, I'll have honey and I've got, you know, t-shirts that say don't tread on bees on them and stuff. So, so there is that there is an Agora Apiaries Facebook page, but I haven't had much to post on there now, but as it's getting closer to, you know, beekeeping season, as the weather warms up, I might be posting more stuff there.
I like bees.
They don't care who the president is. You know, go out and engage in mutually beneficial exchanges with flowers out in the world, and then they go back home. And they don't mess with you, but if you mess with their territory, then they'll let you know in a hostile manner. So it's
Another side tangent you just reminded me of. I was listening to the I don't know if you heard the Anarchitecture podcast. These two
as guys, an architecture.
It's called An Architecture Podcast. These two. I think one guy's an engineer. The other guy's an architect, and they're twin brothers. One of them lives in Boston. The other one lives in Australia. And it's their podcast, right, about anarchism and as it relates to the built environment, which is, you know, buildings and bridges and roads. How do you do
that?
And one episode, he was talking about the ant. Colonies and the ant culture and society, and how so many people equate that as being, look at that, isn't that a wonderful example of central planning, right? Because you have a queen, you have a queen, and you have all these workers that have specific roles, and there's a clear hierarchy, and they don't have immediate knowledge of the other workers, you know, job. They have very specific roles. I guess same thing in the beehive, right?
Right.
And he was saying that no, actually, that is more accurately a reflection of an anarchic society or spontaneous order.
There's more spontaneous order there than there is anything else. Absolutely.
Right, right, because the queen doesn't necessarily give commands. Like, she's basically stuck. No. She can't move.
She's a means of reproduction is how I've had people
right.
bring it up. You know, she lays eggs. And she kind of lays eggs where she's told to by the other workers.
Yeah,
you know, and they are comforted by her. If she is gone, they kind of freak out because then they're the colony's going to die. But right. Yeah, she has no say in it. You know, and there's like a few set rules about how, you know, things get organized. You know, it's like if there's too much space here, they put wax there, and then they fill the wax with honey. Or if there's not enough space here, they put other stuff there.
Right.
But it. Yeah, there's no central command organizing any of that stuff. You know, it's
right. And one of the interesting things he said was that even though the workers, the individual ants have specific roles, depending on the changing in circumstances, like let's say there's a predator that comes and attacks their colony, they all of a sudden go to defend the colony. They abandon their right. roles and they go to defend. Or if they need, I don't know, if a bunch of ants get killed. Then other workers change their roles to fill in for that role. So there's always fluidity and change mm-hmm. to adapt to what's needed. And mm-hmm. so it's fascinating because, I never thought of it like that. So, so it kind of reminded me. So I guess, bees are very similar, right, to ants in that way? Mm-hmm. All right, so awesome.
I need to find that podcast now.
I'll send you. I'll definitely include that. It's really awesome.
All right.
Awesome talking to Jim. So if anybody wants to help me out, you can do so through Bitcoin, Patreon, or PayPal. Links are below. That's patreon.com/peacefulanarchism to help me out. $1 a show is all I ask. I love interviewing fascinating people like Jim here, and I would love to do more of it. Monetary compensation is always encouraged and appreciated, right? We are capitalists in the end. We respond to incentives. Even though I offer these videos for free, we all know that there's no such thing as free time. There's always opportunity cost for everything that we do, right? We're doing something. We're not doing something else. So please help me to encourage me to do more of these through your donations. So thanks a lot, Jim. I really appreciate the conversation.
Oh. Nope. Again, thanks for having me. I enjoyed doing this.
Yeah. So this is Peaceful Anarchism on the Voluntary Virtues Network and theseedsofliberty.com and theconsciousresistance.com. Wishing everyone have a wonderful day. Take care. Bye.
Take care. Bye.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this content and would like to see more of it, please feel free to donate and help me interview other fascinating people. You can do so through Patreon. That's patreon.com/peacefulanarchism to help me out. $1 a show is all I ask. If you feel so inclined to donate more, please feel free. It will only assist me in spreading the message of freedom and voluntarism that much farther and that much more efficiently. You can also donate to my Bitcoin. My Bitcoin address is in the description to my videos as well as on my website, peacefulanarchism.com. And while you're on my site, there's a donate button to donate through PayPal. If you prefer to donate through PayPal, you can do so with that. But Patreon is a little bit easier for content creators, as you can set up a recurring donation if you so desire. Also, while you're on my website, peacefulanarchism.com, please feel free to sign up, enter your email address, sign up for my newsletter, and you'll receive updates every time I post something, a video or an interview. I do not send out any spam. Or you can also follow me on Facebook, under facebook.com/peacefulanarchism or facebook.com/DaniloCuellar3, I believe. DaniloCuellar3. So either one of those methods, if you are able to donate, I would be most appreciative. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you have a magnificent day.
Cell 411 is a free app for Android and iOS that replaces government-controlled 911. Cell 411 allows you to preset a group of friends or private organizations to show up in any emergency. Cell 411 is a nightmare for the state because it proves their so-called services aren't needed. Cell 411 has had thousands of installs, and of course it's covered by the BIPCOT no government license. Cell 411 because your friends won't shoot you when you're in trouble. Without the government, who would build the emergency services? You and Cell 411. Get it today at getcell411.com. That's getcell411.com.